Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You'd expect a guy who's done as well as Warren Buffett has to be an economic optimist. But today, given all that's going on out there, I asked him why.
Every year I could sit down with a yellow pad and write down 20 problems that the country faced. I mean, I could have done that when I was 20 years old. I could do it now. But we've still got a machine that moves forward.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
I'm Kai Rizdahl in New York today. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 27th of November. Good to have you here on this Tuesday. You know, if you want to study American capitalism in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, you could do worse than learning about Warren Buffett. The very name makes people sit up and take notice because, first of all, he's a billionaire 30 or 40 times over, but also because he just has a knack, and I don't think he'd disagree with this characterization, of knowing when and how to invest and what to do with a business. The story of Warren Buffett's life in business is told in a new book by his friend and Fortune magazine writer Carol Loomis. It's called Tap Dancing to Work. It's good to have you both here.
Our pleasure.
Nice to be here.
Mr. Buffett, I want to start with you. You went on Charlie Rose last night, and you said Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, would make a fine Secretary of the Treasury when Timothy Geithner steps down. Why do you think so?
Well, I think he knows more about markets than probably anybody you could find in the world. And I think that if in the next 4 years we run into some kind of a chaos in markets someplace, and who knows, you know, when that can happen, that he would think better about it. He would command the respect of foreign leaders that he might have to coordinate with. I just think he's, you know, he'd be the guy I'd pick for that job.
Well, let's say the president picks him and he gets confirmed. Is that not a vote then for a little bit less regulation in the financial markets? He is no friend of regulation, as you know.
Jamie would not be espousing that, in my view. I mean, in the end, the president would set the tone on that. I do think that it would represent on both sides to a sort of a bygones be bygones, and business and this administration will work together. They'll have things they disagree on. There's no question about that.
Carol Loomis, the question of Warren Buffett and when you knew that he was somebody we all ought to pay attention to. And here's where I have to call you out a little bit. The first time he was in the magazine, Fortune magazine, 1966, you spelled his name wrong.
I did. And he just autographed a book for my daughter, and he deliberately spelled it wrong.
That's almost mean. I don't know.
I'm trying to validate her mother's original.
That was in 1966 that I wrote one sentence about him and misspelled his name. Yeah. My husband met him probably early in 1967. And we became friends, and we bought the stock soon after that. That is kind of the key to when we knew we've never sold.
You put your money where your mouth was.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do I have it right that you still get monthly, sometimes even weekly or daily numbers from your businesses? I read someplace you went over, during the Christmas season, you went over the daily numbers for See's Candy, one of your businesses.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I called the office last night and got the candy figures. I hadn't gotten them since the day before Thanksgiving, and I got them daily, and I not only got them by the store, I got them by the holiday gift centers, and I like numbers.
Wow. One would think you have better things to do with your time. No?
Well, I think you're exposing me.
That's all right with
There's
that.
There's a line in one of the stories in the books that says, never tell him a number that you don't want him to remember because he remembers every number he ever heard.
The other thing you like, besides numbers, is policy. I mean, you are you concentrate on it. You speak out on it occasionally. Most recently in the New York Times yesterday about raising taxes on the wealthy, the fiscal cliff, and the obligation and burdens that, that people ought to share. Do you think this is the time that we have an opportunity to actually do something about taxes and reform and debt and deficit in this country with the fiscal cliff coming?
Oh, I think we will. And, you know, we've kicked it down the road for a long time. But I would say that 90% of the Republicans and 90% of the Democrats understand that you have to raise about 18.5% or thereabouts of GDP and revenue, and they mm-hmm. know that you can spend about 21% and it'll work out okay. They also know that the present course is not sustainable.
You're being really measured here, and I appreciate that you understand the weight that your words carry in this economy. Do you not think, though, that you could speak out forcefully and oblige people to get something done using this role you've built over the past 55, 60 years in this economy?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't put it that strongly. But when I wrote the op-ed piece for the New York Times, I was giving something of a blueprint, and I really challenged Congress to come up with this 18.5 and 21 mixture, which millions of Americans understand that's the answer. And I would say a majority of the Congress does. They just they're afraid of primaries to some extent.
Yeah. What's the most important thing that anybody has to know about Warren Buffett?
Well, I think the central thing about Warren is that he is totally rational about investing. Most people are gripped by emotion when they're considering the investment. The stock goes down and they panic and they sell. Warren just buys more.
You have this reputation as this oracle, the Oracle of Omaha. People hang on your every word. Do you deserve it?
No.
But, not true.
Carol says I'm rational, and I am. But being rational means that when I try to decide whether a stock is worth $100 a share or $200 a share, I look at the facts. I don't pay any attention to what other people are saying about something. I just look at the facts. But I can be an emotional guy. Just watch me in a Nebraska football game.
Yeah, well, it's fair enough. You've been bullish on the American economy for your whole working life. I mean, forever. Are you still, even today, with the political problems we have, with the recession that's dragging, with ordinary Americans who sort of can't believe they can ever get ahead again, are you still bullish?
More bullish than ever. I mean—
Why?
Well, this country since 1776 has had the secret of unlocking human potential. I mean, we're not any smarter than people were in 1776, and we don't work any harder.
What's your biggest worry? What's your biggest fear about the American economy?
Well, I really don't have any. I don't have a fear about.
Oh, come on!
No, I really don't. I mean, sure, there are all kinds of problems. Every year, I could sit down with a yellow pad and write down 20 problems that the country faced. I mean, I could have done that when I was 20 years old. I could do it now, but we've still got a machine that moves forward. It doesn't do it. You know, it's in fits and starts, and you know, we have our bubbles, and we have our the bubbles pop, and all of that sort of thing. We had a civil war. We had, you know, two world wars. We had the Great Depression. But if you look at the markers as to where the tide is going, I mean, it just keeps coming in.
You actually say somewhere in the writings in this book that buying Berkshire Hathaway in 1965 or whatever it was a mistake.
Correct.
Why?
Well, I started with a textile business that was doomed for failure. It took me 20 years to realize that. But if I'd done the other things without the burden of the textile business, I'd have been far richer, and so would our shareholders.
The book by Carol Loomis about the working life of Warren Buffett is called Tap Dancing the Work. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Nice to be here.
There is more Warren Buffett coming up tomorrow on our morning show with Jeremy Hobson. It is The Things That Money Can't Buy.
I found what I liked when I was in my 20s or earlier. I mean, I found what I like to eat. I found the kind of people I like to associate with. I found what I like to do during the day, how I like to dress, what I like to watch on TV. And I've seen no reason to change just because I got richer.
Warren Buffett, regular guy. That's tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. Shares of Berkshire Hathaway, by the way, lost about 0.3% today, $400 or so. Closed, if you can believe it, just a hair over $132,000 a piece. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The typical college graduate leaves school these days owing more than $25,000 in student loans, a lot of money. So what if you could get a degree for less than half of that? It's an idea that's catching on in states like Texas and now in Florida. Governor Rick Scott has challenged that state's community colleges to come up with a $10,000 bachelor's degree. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When you think community college, you might think two-year associate's degree. But these days, many community colleges are expanding to offer low-priced bachelor's degrees. A bachelor's in business at the College of Central Florida already costs just $13,500. So how do you shave that down to 10 grand?
Well, it's definitely possible.
College President Jim Henningsen says students could save some money taking courses in high school for college credit. And the rest?
We think we can do a scholarship program to help supplant those costs.
Programs like this already exist in Texas, but there's a difference between the price students pay for college and the cost of actually providing the education. Economist David Feldman is co-author of the book, Why Does College Cost So Much? He says scholarships just shift the burden to someone else.
Is it possible to price a degree at $10,000? Yeah, sure. Is it possible to produce a degree for $10,000? That's a much more difficult proposition.
Florida's community colleges are looking at ways to actually cut costs by mixing in some online courses and helping students graduate on time. Feldman says right now the $10,000 degree is mostly a gimmick.
If this generates real thinking about how to hold down costs in ways that don't lower quality, more power to it.
Right off the bat, several of Florida's state and community colleges pledged to give it some thought. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
ConAgra, the packaged food conglomerate, got even more conglomerate-y today. The company claims you can already find its brand name products in 97% of American households. Now, it wants to get in on what's called the private label market as well, those in-store brands that are just a little bit cheaper. ConAgra has bought the private label manufacturer Ralcorp for $5 billion, as Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
You gotta have beef. You gotta have spice. You gotta have excitement.
Step into a Slim Jim!
ConAgra, the company responsible for Slim Jim, this whipped cream in a can.
The sound of Ready Whip is the sound of joy.
And
100% Hebrew National Delicious.
Is toning things down. Not all the way down to the two-tone black and white generic foods you may remember from back in the day, but to private label or store brands. Think Whole Foods 365 or Safeway's O.
Private label has outperformed branded almost every year since 1998. We believe there's a long runway ahead.
That's Gary Rodkin, the CEO of ConAgra, in this morning's conference call about the deal.
Practically everything that you're going to see that ConAgra produces has a store brand to it.
Phil Lempert's a food industry analyst. He says that consumers in this economy want brand name quality cheap. And he says those private labels cost less, not because they skimp on quality, but marketing and fancy packaging. So it makes sense for ConAgra to buy into that market.
Now they're going to have it from both sides, from the branded side and from the store brand. And especially if you look at the different generations, for example, baby boomers are very brand-oriented. The millennial generation is less brand-oriented.
And Lempert says ConAgra's acquisition of private label manufacturer Ralcorp means all consumers, baby boomers and millennials, can look forward to store brands tasting even more like their brand name faves. I wonder what Safeway would call its version of a Slim Jim. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
President Obama met with Mexican President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto at the White House today. Immigration and the war on drugs, among other things, were on the agenda. Marijuana was legalized earlier this month in Colorado and Washington State, which has some in Mexico talking about turning an illegal cash crop into a legal export. Jennifer Collins has that story.
In a few days, Enrique Peña Nieto will move into the presidential palace and his security policy will become the law of the land, including the war on drugs. That's led to deadly clashes between cartels and Mexican security forces.
Retírese para allá.
A local news crew caught this shootout a few months ago in Ciudad Juarez, less than 3 miles from the U.S. border.
It's a war.
Jorge Javier Romero is a professor of political science at Mexico's Autonomous Metropolitan University.
It's not a Mexican war. It's an international war. It's an American war.
An estimated 60,000 people have died, and billions of dollars have been spent fighting drug cartels. But now that Colorado and Washington State have legalized marijuana, the game's changed, says top Mexican official Luis Videgaray.
This is a product that is illegal in Mexico. We try to stop it from being transferred to the United States, but the United States, at least in some parts of it, now has a different legal status. I think that forces us to rethink our security policies.
Videgaray says there are no plans to legalize marijuana in Mexico. When security forces come across plantations like this one, they found in Baja California last year, they're instructed to destroy them. Clearly, plenty gets through. Experts here say Mexican marijuana makes up as much as two-thirds of the pot smoked in the U.S. And some in Mexico's pot-growing regions fear Colorado and Washington could displace their product. They want a legal way to export the drug. Don't hold your breath, says Alejandro Hope of the think tank Mexican Institute for Competitiveness. But
if there is full legalization, could there be Mexican marijuana export to the U.S.? Yes, probably.
More immediately, political scientist Jorge Javier Romero says legalization could help end Mexico's protracted war on drugs.
The money that the cartels have is going to be reduced. So they are going to have less money to have weapons and to have armies. So the violence in the long term is going to be reduced.
Then he says the money Mexico now spends battling the cartels could be used to rebuild the country instead. In Mexico City, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, you play the Powerball lottery, the states win.
We went through the election, and it was all let the rich people pay the bills. But this is one where the poor people pay the bills.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, let's see. You take more worries about the fiscal cliff. You add in lower growth projections. Bang, the Dow Industrials off 89 points, 2/3%. 12,878, the number you're looking for. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points, 1/3%. 29.67 at the bell. The S&P 500 dropped 7 points, 0.5%. Finished at 1398. Investors larded up shares of RALCorp more than 25% following the acquisition by ConAgra that we mentioned. ConAgra sprouted 4.75% higher. A new blow for big tobacco. A federal judge said today that cigarette makers must take out ads saying they deliberately misled consumers on the dangers of smoking. Shares of Philip Morris coughed up a drop of 0.8%. Reynolds American off a fraction. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of October. The Federal Reserve issues its final beige book of the year. It summarizes current economic conditions. And you still have a few days to take advantage of this one. November is National Peanut Butter Lovers Month. According to the National Peanut Board, the average kid will eat 1,500 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches before graduating high school. But I don't think it's just for kids. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. This is, as you know, the season of shopping. It's the season of fully stocked store shelves, at least here in the early days, which means it's also the season of supply chains, of stores doing whatever they have to do to have their goods at hand. We're spending some time this week on the world's biggest supply chain, Walmart, and how it gets its stuff to market. Yesterday, Mitchell Hartman was telling us about people who work for the temporary staffing agencies that Walmart relies on to move its crates and its boxes. Today, Walmart's supply chain has a very successful business model. For them, here's Mitchell with part two.
USC geographer Juan DeLara has taken me to a highway embankment in East Los Angeles.
Well, we're looking at an intermodal shipping facility.
He's explaining the retail supply chain that moves Asian goods from the huge ports of Southern California to stores and distribution centers.
And what you see in front of us is thousands and thousands of shipping containers that will end up going to places like Dallas-Fort Worth or to Chicago.
Few Americans ever see a place like this, says DeLara.
It's kind of symbolic of the invisible nature of the commodity chain, where American consumers, all they know is the end product, right? The thing that you go in to buy at a Walmart.
And for Delara, the invisible link that's most problematic is thousands of low-wage temp workers who move this stuff. They're invisible, says Delara, because they're not on the payroll of the big box retailers. Working near minimum wage with no benefits, they're barely a drag on the bottom line. Holly Kent Payne unloads shipping containers for Walmart outside Chicago. She makes $10 an hour, working about 30 hours a week. Walmart owns the warehouse. Another company, Schneider Logistics, runs it. Kent Payne works for a temp agency called Roadlink.
You know, you're easily replaceable. That's just something that they're always emphasizing. You know, if you're not, like, working hard enough, oh, we can just get someone else.
Curtis Tucker works in the same warehouse. I met them last month in Bentonville, Arkansas. They went with a labor group to Walmart's home office to protest their treatment as low-wage permatemps.
We all live in boxes the same. If I live in a 50-pound box, the person next to me is living in a 50-pound box. So we should all have benefits and equal wages, you know?
USC's Juan Delara says the permatemps are there by design. The industry keeps costs down for retailers at the top of the supply chain by utilizing low-skilled, low-wage contract workers at the bottom.
When you offer these services up for bid, many of these fly-by-night temp agencies will bid so low. Companies like Walmart can avoid overhead costs. They don't have to pay HR costs on that. So it saves them a lot of money, and it saves them a lot of liability.
It's very hard to say this is the secret sauce.
That's MIT logistics professor Yossi Sheffy. He says Walmart's secret sauce isn't using temp workers to lowball labor costs. It's having the flexibility to adjust the labor force to match market demand.
What's the main competitive advantage? They said the same tchotchkes that a lot of other people are selling, but they do it cheaper, faster, better. It's the ability to move enormous quantity of goods around the world in the most efficient manner.
Sheffy says that means having the most sophisticated logistics software and inventory management. But he readily admits it also means having a fair number of temps in the warehouses. That way the retailer can instantly staff up or down when the new iPad comes out or to fill shelves before Christmas with all those tchotchkes. Sheffy says these temp jobs may not be great, but there is room to move up. He says salaries can reach into the low 40,000s, comparable to other blue-collar jobs.
This industry educates its own workers, believes in experience on the floor. If you look at UPS and many, many other companies, most of the executives started on the floor. So this provides an element of social justice and upward mobility that's not always existing in other industries.
But many temporary warehouse workers doubt they'll ever get permanent employment, let alone a path to the middle class. Tomorrow, we'll hear how organized labor is trying to hold the marquee retailers responsible for the low-wage workers who move their goods. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Lots of comments on our Walmart series at marketplace.org. Here's one from a former Walmart part-timer. Walmart pays better than most places, this person said. If I ever need to earn some extra cash, I'll apply there first over other places. I'm sorry people don't see the opportunity to earn money with part-time jobs is something to celebrate. If Walmart was so bad, they wouldn't get so many people applying. We always want to hear what you have to say, good, bad, or otherwise. Go to marketplace.org or hit us up on our Facebook page. Interestingly enough, not once during the whole time I was talking to Warren Buffett today did I really think, wow, this guy's worth a bajillion dollars. I wonder what that's like. This next story, though, does get the juices flowing. Tomorrow's big Powerball drawing is worth 500 million simoleons, half a billion dollars or more. Second biggest prize ever, by the way. It's nice, right? But Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports whoever draws the winning numbers tomorrow isn't the only winner in this game.
Back in January, the 33 states that run the Powerball game unveiled a little wrinkle. $2 tickets, up from a buck.
We wanted to do something special with Powerball, with larger and faster growing jackpots.
Chuck Strutt runs Powerball for the Multi-State Lottery Association.
We just thought it was the right time to do that, the right economy to do that, and it's been a tremendous success for us.
Sure. Who wouldn't love to double your prices and see sales soar 35%? Strutt says Powerball's on track to generate a record-setting $5 billion this fiscal year. Half of that money goes for prizes. States take the other half and often spend it on school scholarships, environmental projects, even prescription drug relief. UNLV professor Bill Thompson says there's just one problem. That's the source of the lottery revenue.
We went through the election, and it was all let the rich people pay the bills. But this is one where the poor people pay the bills.
But Thompson concedes when purses get giant-sized, people who can and can't afford it scoop up tickets, even with odds at 175 million to 1. I asked musician Mike Fisher why people do that, as he played his guitar outside a subway stop in downtown Philadelphia.
Mind a chance to dream. Because if you don't have a dream, what's the purpose of getting up? You got to feel like you're working towards something.
Fisher's dream? A yacht, so he can live on the water and fish all the time. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one last pearl of wisdom from Warren Buffett. It's from before we actually started the interview, random banter that I do just to see how everybody sounds. Here you go.
Mr. Buffett, what'd you have for breakfast, sir?
Oreos and milk.
Oreos? Seriously?
Yeah. No, I'm staying at the Essex House, and I bought a half gallon of milk, and I bought yesterday I had a bunch of Oreos, and I had it yesterday, I'll have it today, and I'll have it tomorrow, and then I'll leave.
See, the rich are just like the rest of us, except that guy is flying home on his private plane. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 89 points, about two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 dropped 7 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points. That is a third of 1%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada B. Don't forget, more Warren there tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I will be back in L.A. tomorrow. See you there. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.